Hi, this is Keith Wooden, and welcome to Story Mosaic. We have an incredible opportunity today, and it's brought to us by Frontgate Media for helping us get connected with David Alford and Joseph Stamm. We're going to kind of dive right into this. And one of the essences of Story Mosaic is that we believe that everyone has a story, and that when we tell our stories, it kind of brings us together, creates community between us, but it also lets people into a little bit of the heart of who we are. And so, David, I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind. This is David Alford. And I'm going to ask David if he wouldn't mind sharing one of his stories. And I'm going to be honest with you. David said, "I'm telling the story because I'm older than Joseph." So
why don't you don't see it on camera? No, I'll just let you know.
Barely.
I'm a little bit older.
Barely.
Well, and I have a couple of filters on, so it's really helping you a lot, David. Just kidding. If I had any filters, do you think I'd look like this? So, David, I just want you to take a page out of your life, or put a pin in the timeline of your life, and something that kind of changed the course or put you on a new course in life, something that impacted you, whether it's humorous or serious. I would love for you to share one of your stories.
I appreciate that. And I'm going to take us way back in the time machine to when I was about 15.
Oh,
and
wow.
This was, I guess, around 82, somewhere around there. And so I was in high school, just graduated out of middle school. And I was one of those super shy kids. I was the kid who was like the thick glasses in the back of the room, who was reading the thick paperback novels. You know, I was on like the third Dune book by, you know, halfway through the semester. And I didn't talk much. I mean, I wouldn't even ask questions in class. I'd wait till the class was over and everyone would leave. And I'd go up to the teacher and ask individually because I was just really shy. I'd gone through some family trauma and I just was really closed up and didn't really get out much. And so going into high school as a freshman, things didn't look to get much better of that year because I was pretty much in the same place. But I had a carpool, a person I rode home with after school. And so she and I had to stay after a little bit for school before her grandmother picked us up because she wanted to audition for the school's one act play. And so it's like a competition play where you know, they go and compete against other schools. And so I stayed with her because I had to, and I had my book and I was really ready to read the next chapter. And so she said, "Well, come on into the room. I've got to do the audition. It should only take about 15, 20 minutes. So I sat in the back of the room and I kind of started reading and I started watching kind of what the kids were doing. And I watched her audition. And I watched the other actors she was with. And these were like the seniors and the juniors of the high school program. These were like the really good actors. They were serious. They were like down from Mount Olympus, good actors kind of thing. And I was so impressed by them because they were so composed and they were so funny and they were so seemingly confident about the way they carried themselves. And then they had just play the audience to the film. And I was like, wow, these guys are so good. And so after the audition was over, my friend was done. We got up our books to leave and the teacher turned and goes, you're up next. I'm like, oh no, I'm not here to audition. She's just my ride home. So I'm just waiting for her. And so the teacher goes, well, give it a try. Why not? I'm like, no, I'm not an actor. I just watched all these really incredible kids perform. I'm like, I'm not like them.
That's right.
Down my head. You know, and so she said, no, see, I'm not going to make you, but I think you should try. My friend went, go ahead and try. Only take a few minutes. And there was a part of me that kind of thought, well, why not? You know, I'll give it a shot. I'll take a risk. And so as shy as I was, I thought, I'll take the risk. So I got up and I read with the kids and they all had beautiful, pristine British accents. And I was trying not to sound like a Texan, you know. It was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The Chronicles of Narnia was the play.
Famous
and
one.
So of course, I had read all of the novels four or five times, had the collection in my room. So I was familiar with the story. And so I guess that's probably partly what appealed to me to at least give it a shot. So anyhow, I did the audition. I was so blind with fear. I have no idea how it went. I think afterwards, I don't remember. I think I blacked out halfway through it. So the next day at lunch, my friend comes up to me and she goes, I just want you to know, I'm not speaking to you anymore. And
oh,
I'm
no.
Like, what happened?
No more ride home.
No more. I think she has to take me home by legal obligation, but she's not going to talk to me in the car. I said, what? She said, you got cast. I'm like, I got cast? She's like, yeah, you're playing Peter, the oldest son of the Narnia kids.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, what part are you going? She goes, I didn't get cast. I'm like, oh. That's the problem. That's where the tension formed right there. So I was so surprised. I had no idea. And so I went to these practices after school and started working with these kids, and I felt like an imposter the entire time. But we went to competitions, and our school was pretty good in their theater department. And so we went through levels of competition where we'd win rounds and go to another school a couple of weeks later. And I'd get a little pass from my teacher that says, "Please excuse him from class today. He's going on a field trip." I'm like,
That's great.
"Whoa, this is so cool. I get to skip school and go do theater." So we went to school after school. It was like a bad episode of Glee. Each theater stage was a larger, shinier, fancier version of the one before. And we finally made it to state, because our school often did. And so it was really exciting. We ended up not winning state, but at the end of the award ceremony, they gave individual acting awards. And I about fell out of my chair when I got called up for best actor, and I'd never won anything. I mean, I'd always been like fifth place in Cub Scouts, or I got like the soccer trophy that everybody on the team gets. That's about all I had on my little trophy shelf. I'd never won anything. I thought surely they've made a mistake. It's one of these great actors I'm with. They meant to call, they just got the names wrong. But I took the prize home anyway, whether it was right or wrong.
That's right.
But anyhow, I'd gotten the theater bug after that. I was
That's right.
totally, all through high school, college, and as an adult, I've been kind of dancing around. I never did it as a career because I wanted to have a family and I wanted to be kind of a constant, something more constant and consistent. So I never pursued it as a career, but as an adult, I'd performed in, regional theater professionally, toured a little bit, done some local theater, done all kinds of levels for years. So fast forward 33 years later, and my wife and my oldest daughter and I are in New York City, and we're going to go see Newsies. We're taking our daughter to go see Newsies. She was 16. That was
Great
such a
show.
perfect show. That was the only reason we were allowed to go to New York in her eyes. So we went to go there, and we stopped by the Drama Bookshop, which is in New York City. I think it's closed now, but it's the largest theater bookshop you could possibly imagine. Several stories of like playbooks and play collections and lighting and costume and directing. I was in hog heaven. I was walking around this bookstore. I could have spent a week in this bookstore looking at every book. And while I'm there, I find an annual. And it's an annual that lists all the American theaters from Broadway to off-Broadway to regional theaters that were performed that year. And it's an annual book they put out every year. And I had been working at a regional theater for a couple of years. And I thought, well, I'll see if our theater happens to be in here. So I flip open the book, and sure enough, our theater's listed with our season and all the cast. And there's my name in the book as cast for our theater. I'm like, that is so cool. I was like, I did not expect this. And of course, I'm smart enough to know that it's not a big deal to anybody but me, but it was a big deal to me to have my name there.
Yeah.
So I looked at a different year because I've been at that theater for several years, opened it up, and there was a photo next to the season that I was in, I was prominently in, of a show that we had done at that theater. So there's my picture in another annual and another thing. I'm sitting here in New York City in, theater district, looking at my picture and a name in a book that's, for National Theater, annuals. And I thought, gosh, that little 15-year-old knobby-kneed kid just said, "I guess I'll give it a shot." And it's all, and I just want to show back and tell him, "Hey, it worked. We did it. Look how
Yeah.
far you've come. This is not about fame. This is just about, it's about taking a step and about being courageous and then seeing how far it goes."
Man, you're
And
so spot on when you talk about the courage that it takes, and plus it gave you some street cred with your daughter. She's seeing your name.
yeah, she was impressed.
That's,
Yeah.
hey, Joseph, you started in a little bit different pathway, if I'm not mistaken. You started a little bit more towards the film and on screen. Is that where you started as well?
For me, I had started in theater when I was a lot younger, actually. So I started when I was about 7 or 8 or something like that in
Okay, that's
theater, in
right.
actually the theater program that David started. And so David, had the courage to not only go out there and take the step himself, but he's also gone on to create spaces for kids to do that exact same thing, which
I
I think was
love
really
that.
special. And did that same thing for me, made that space for me to be able to, take that step. So I got to play Peter Pan when I was, 7 or 8 years old, and I was off to the races after that. I loved it. But yeah, I was did the theater program at the Bardo Theater that David started, the youth program, and did shows all through high school. But I think it was in that after doing the shows in the Bardo for a while, and through that, when he left to go start his production company, he asked me to audition for Cross Purposes, the first film that we did together. And so it was yeah, it was through the theater kind of that I kind of got there.
Yeah.
But I was about 16 years old at the time, and then since then I've really been focused on film ever since.
You know, David, I love your heart and the fact that you were launching kids through theater into their lives. And you know what? I think the magic of that, in terms of my viewpoint, is that any kid, it doesn't matter, any kid can step on the stage and they can find a voice. And it is an amazing transformation. And I've been a part of watching these students as they start in theater and then they blossom in not only theater, but film, et cetera. And it's just amazing. And so that is so cool, David, that it was been on your heart. But Joseph brought up something very interesting is that you talked about courage, and this courage is so very, very important in this. Because you took a next courageous step in starting a production company. Man, that had to be nerve-wracking.
I think I was too clueless to be very scared. I had no
Okay.
idea what I was doing or how complicated it was. I
Yeah,
had
that's right. Okay.
I was dumb walking into it. I didn't figure, I just talked to some people around here. I actually was writing a play for a playwright competition that we have at the theater here. And I thought, well, this doesn't really work as a stage play, but maybe it would work as a film screenplay. And I'd never written one before, didn't really know how, but talked to some friends who had done some short films before. And I said, do you think this might work? And they said, yeah, I think this is really solid. And I think it's worth it. So we just talked in our little area to people around here who had done some small film work and got a crew together and made the film. And when I needed an actor, I had all these kids in my theater program. I have
There you
hundreds of
go.
students. So when I needed a 16-year-old actor to play a kid with cancer, I was like, where am I going to find this person? And so I just put a cast call. I probably auditioned about 30 kids, 16-year-old boys. And sure enough, Joseph was one of them. And I had known him. Socially, our families had kind of grown up together. We're both homeschool families, so my kids have grown up with him and his brothers and sisters. So I'd known him, but I'd never really worked with him very much in acting. And so when he came and did the audition, it was just kind of magic, and I was just blown away at how genuine and authentic he is as an actor. And that you've seen his films, you know what I'm talking about.
You know, I think it boils down to whether the actor can reach all the way to the back row. You know what I mean? It's one thing to be able to play to an audience that is in the first three rows, but if your character can reach the back, and then in this case, Joseph, one of the things that I really noticed in viewing and screening the film was how much you project not just into a two-dimensional, but into very much a three-dimensional person. I'm feeling it. I'm with you in the on the screen, and I'm really sensing who you are. And there were times that I really hated you.
Thank you. That is like the best compliment that I could have gotten. Well,
Am
I've had no that. I've
serious.
said that many times.
Yeah, no.
Why is this news to you, Joseph?
No, but I appreciate that you said that so much because yeah, I mean, especially when you're doing a film like this that's about someone that's addicted to drugs, that's a drug addict, a lot of people, you the easy thing to go to is to is the drug addiction and play him as a drug addict. And David had written this super three-dimensional person in the
Yes.
script, and so obviously I wanted to honor that in my performance. And so we worked together, for 4 months before the shoot started, developing him, developing the backstory, from his earliest childhood memories up until, the film starts to feel like there's a whole life being lived before
Yeah.
and after this film, before and after the frame. And so yeah, like that was super important. And then that was the thing that we went back and forth about sometimes because I felt like David had written a very sympathetic character in the film, but he's also frustrating. And I didn't want to pull any punches with how frustrating he can be.
Oh.
And because we talked about it, and David said like often that's how family members of of
Yes.
drug addicts feel. I mean, there's this love and this connection that they have to these people, but they're as frustrating as anything, you know, at other times. And so kind of wanted the audience to feel that same way about him, you know.
And Joseph, one of the things you just mentioned there was what's the easy emotion to go to? And I always find for a lot of actors, the easy emotion is anger. Anger's a front row seat emotion. But when you start digging into the deeper emotions of a person and the drives, that's where we get what you've labeled and what I've labeled that three-dimensional character. And so, David, how did you go about the writing of this? Are you a solo writer? Do you write in a group? How do you approach script writing?
I've done most of the scripts myself. Joseph, after that first little film, has started kind of, he tapped into his writing skills. So he and I have been writing together, and he actually helped me write Searching for the Elephant as well. I kind of did the lead writing. He kind of came in and did some cleaning and polishing and really shaped the characters and the situations and gave them a lot of life. So the two of us write as a team now. But with that particular story, it was a weird thing. I was looking at some medieval castles. And I was looking at the way that medieval castles have walls and armament built up designed to keep enemy armies out. And I started realizing this is kind of what some people do with their personalities. And I was trying to find some connections between some of the battlements and armory and the way that strategies and the way that we as people keep other people out of our lives. And so I thought, how interesting would it be if two characters who had built up all these walls to push the world away from
Right.
them were
That's right.
forced to live in a house together. You know, and those two castles are right next door to each other. Would war break out? Would they find a way to work together? So these two main characters, Jason and his grandfather, have both in their own ways cut the world out of their lives and have pushed everybody that loves them away. But now they're locked in a house together and they have to stay on this ranch alone, or a farm, I guess, alone together. And we just watch the process of the walls being chipped away. And
Yeah.
sometimes it's a violent process, sometimes it's an angry process, sometimes it's funny, you know, and it's just watching these two men find each other and work through it was kind of the challenge of the story.
And some of those typologies that you've mentioned between the fortresses and the castles really start to emerge through these characters because they have seemingly a vested interest in holding the other person at arm's length. And now I know that these scenes are not necessarily shot in the order that we see them.
No.
And so there are times when you're diving back into an earlier moment or a moment that's later on because you don't want to go through all the setup again and go through all the cameras again. So you're having to shoot two or three scenes in that bedroom scene or something like that. Joseph, how do you go about tapping into your character in those settings?
Yeah, that's a really good question. A lot of it is in the preparation of I kind of have these checkpoints for myself of headspaces that I can tap back into beforehand so that I know, you know, so that, you know, just prepare ahead of time. This is where I'm coming from, this is where I'm going to. And so I have these checkpoints, so it's really easy to slip into on the day when we have to turn on a dime, you know, and do a scene from the beginning of the film and then a scene from the end of the film, you know, all in one space.
All
And
in one
so
space.
it's all in the preparation for me, and getting myself in the right headspace. And it can be tough sometimes though. I mean, I think you mentioned the bedroom, which was interesting because that one of the scenes there, I think the confrontation I have with my grandfather after the police interaction, that one I was one of the toughest days for me. I think I was just tired. I don't know what it was. I just couldn't. Nothing was coming out right. Everything just felt so fake and so bad. I remember just stopping in front and in one take and just being like, this is just all fake. I don't know. There's nothing real here. I can't do it. And so like David was very patient with me. Everyone was very patient with me, you know, to try to go off by myself and find it. And David came and helped talk things out, and we kind of found a new angle on it. And it ended up being really great in the end because what was really great is you just freed me from everything I thought the scene had to be,
Yes.
and really just lived in it. And I couldn't have necessarily told you what happened, but it came out so much differently than it ever had before. And then and so watching it, I don't remember that I did half of that. It was just, it just felt like I was living in it. So I was glad that we could get to that place. But it's a hard road, to get there
Yeah.
sometimes.
Well, and the reason why I mentioned that scene, and there's several gripping scenes in the scope of the movie. The reason why I mentioned that scene is it looked like it was one of those scenes that was you just didn't walk in and deliver the lines. Now you as a director, David, now you as an actor, you both had to enter into that scene with the same energy that you needed to come out of the scene with. And so it was obvious that something had taken place there. I'm always looking for continuity, and continuity is one of my big things. And that one didn't slip out of continuity with the rest of the film. Well,
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
David, I have to ask you a kind of a strange question is there is a process of stepping from in front of the camera or on the stage to moving now to behind and looking at it through a different angle, looking at it through a different perspective. Have you made that kind of that trans, I'm going to call it a transgression, but have you made that transition away from being in front of the camera or on the stage to now looking through a different lens? Is this your primary role now?
It is, yeah. I've always enjoyed live performances, and I think being an actor on stage has actually given me a lot of tools. Because after years and years of being in the room with the audience, knowing what makes them laugh, knowing what makes
There
them
you go.
think, and when it stops, and feeling it in the room in the middle of the show, you can feel if the audience is with you. And knowing when that moment is and what's going on stage and doing that for years actually is a really big help in getting behind the camera. Because behind the camera, you have no audience, you have nothing. You just have to go off instincts and what you hope will land with the audience in the way you hope it will land there. And I think all those years working with live audiences actually made filming a better experience for me. I would leave the set going, I think we have what we've got. And when
That's
we
right.
go to the previews and there were actual audiences there and they reacted the way I hoped they would, I'm like, okay, we did hit it. And I think my live theater life has really been a big part of it. But making movies has been, it's this is going to sound horribly controlling, but you do have a lot more control in film than you do in theater. If you're
Yes.
directing a play, you've got a whole stage full of living beings and you're trying to guide the audience's eye to one place or another to look at something, but there's a whole panorama of things happening, and the audience can kind of look at what they want to look at when they want to
That's
look at it.
right.
As a movie director, I have complete control of your eyeballs, so I can take you where I want you to go. And so the control factor of filmmaking is actually kind of it's kind of a powerful drug, but it's a lot of fun too because you have
Oh
so
man.
much say.
You know what? When you say that, David, it's so interesting because I'm ADD, okay? So one of the reasons why I love live theater is you can't tell me where I have to look. I can look at anything, okay? I love that. And that's why I'm a little bit in opposition. I fight back with the artist who's directing me, look here, don't look there. And yet you're absolutely right, is you have control over the viewpoint and the viewfinder in that case. And it's such a powerful, powerful medium. And I'm glad to hear you talk about how in those moments you know when you just struck lightning, or
Yes.
lightning struck, I should say. You
Yes.
know when
Yeah.
that moment is and you go there. And then when you get to screen it, that has to be such a powerful, powerful moment to see an audience go, yeah, they laughed just where I wanted them to, or they just were silent. David, I love what you're saying there, and I love how that has been an evolution in your process. Hey, I've got a couple of tough questions to ask though. But I think they're fun questions. And I think it leads us into a philosophical base of screenwriting and understanding where you go because Cross Purposes and Frontgate Media both define themselves as kind of connecting the medium of film and the medium of even podcasts, with this medium of our faith. And some films choose to do that very much in your face, and then other films do not. And I would call your film what I, and this is just a personal a personal term, but a redemptive film as opposed to a quote unquote Christian film. Is that fair to say? Do you understand what I'm saying when I define those two?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I definitely understand what you mean by that, and I would tend to agree. I think, I mean, we always say it's funny when we talk about Christian films because a film can't be Christian necessarily. So it's like,
Only
but
people,
only people can be Christian.
Objects, thoughts, ideas aren't Christian.
But
People.
I know what people are saying by that, but yeah. So I think for us, I mean, yeah, it is a story about redemption and forgiveness and isolation, and it's exploring all these themes. And I don't know, the way I've always thought about it is that it comes from us, and we are Christians, and so we can't help that it's going to come from our perspective and our worldview. And so if we're being really honest and we're telling a personal, truthful story, then it can't help but involve that because it comes from us. But we always make a very conscious effort to not hit the audience over the head, not spoon feed the audience anything, especially when it comes to messages, because I think a really incredible tool that we have in art in general, and especially in filmmaking, is subjectivity. And it for leaving space enough for people to project their own experiences onto the film, and then get from it things that we either did intend or never even thought of ourselves, but it doesn't matter. We've at least left enough space in that subjectivity for them to project their own experiences. And I would say for God to work in that subjectivity and bring about something. And so we're always really careful to not try to control it so much. And we talk about control, and we do want control. And so that's why we have to remind ourselves sometimes to take a step back and not force the audience into this way of thinking, because an audience fears that. The audience doesn't want to be manipulated. Film is already manipulating enough, as it
That's
is.
right.
So we don't need to be any more, and the audience can feel that, and it makes everything feel fake. And that's the worst thing we could have done with this film in every regard. I mean, as an actor, I was worried about, the addiction side of things coming across as fake, the themes coming across as fake, the people coming across as fake. Again, film is already manipulative and fake enough in his essence. We're trying to capture something as real and truthful and honest as we can.
And as Christians, I think we can do more harm to the Christian cause by presenting stories that feel manipulative. And people look at our stories and go, well, that's what it looks like on Hallmark, but that isn't what my life looks like. And so when they sense that, well, then Christianity must be manipulative and fake as well. And we can project that onto our own belief system and turn people away from Christ rather than drawing them to them. And we don't have the answers for that 100%, but we do believe that it's okay to ask hard questions. My God's big enough to answer hard questions. And we don't always have to have pat answers in our art. Asking the questions and looking at God is enough, and people can do that. And we always talk about, when you look at a beautiful picture in an art gallery, you start applying your own life experiences to that art piece. And you look at it and you go, oh, this affects me in this way. And the person next to me, it affects them completely differently. And Christian media and Christian art has, there's been some fantastic examples of Christian art and media that are wonderful, wonderful films. But a lot of times they kind of read like road signs, like the word stop or go or right lane or yield. And the information is just told to you smack dab in your face. There's no room for anything but just And we have road signs for that. We don't need art to do that. We don't need the art to spell it out and hit people in the face and say, this is what you should think, and this is how you should think it, and this is what God means. We don't need that in our art. We've got that in other areas that are important areas of life, but art needs to be subjective. People need to be allowed to see themselves and see God within it without you telling them everything to think and to breathe and do.
I love this, and I'm so glad we're approaching this because I think it is absolutely essential in the industry. And I'm not in the industry, okay? I'm a podcast host, but I understand what's the nature of what you're speaking of. And both of you came from the point of view of saying it is about leaving room for the audience to discover, to the subjective nature is the nature of discovery. And when I discover it for myself, rather than it being told to me, it's going to have a longer lasting, deeper impression. And that's what it's all about. Because if I tell them there's only a 1%, and this is borne out statistically, there's only a 1% chance that it's going to stick. But if they discover it, the odds of that impression and that idea sticking in their heart and in their brain, it just is magnified by so many percentages. And
Well,
that's what we want to
that's
do.
so true. Like, here's an example of that. Like that's so true in the filmmaking process itself. There's so many scenes that I know that David knows what he wants from me from the very beginning, but he's not going to tell me what he wants from me in the scene. He's going to ask the right questions and he's going to guide and direct me until I find it myself.
That's
Because if
it.
he told me, then I would just be performing what he told me and that would be very fake. And so I need to find it for myself and I need to find my own way to it, and it might be exactly what he was looking for the entire time, but it doesn't matter. I found it myself, and so now it's coming across a lot more authentic and real because it is real to me.
And it's the beauty of rather than telling people what to think, we're inviting them to discover how to think. How to discover these things. And that was, you know what? And you spoke earlier, Joseph, about worldview. And that is what I feel like comes through in this particular film, very clearly is the worldview is the root of the film, not just the dialogue, not just the acting. It's the very root of it is the worldview that comes through. And I want to just compliment you guys so much on that process because that wasn't easy. I love the fact that you guys spent like 4 months together and you already knew each other and that you're still sitting here together and you like each other.
You caught us on a good day.
Okay,
It's not usually like this. Yeah, it's revealed, honestly. No,
No,
it's true. And I'll only put a caveat on that too. It's like we have films that are evangelical. We have films that deliver the Christian message overtly and specifically. That's needed and that's there. But when we sell people this idea that if you accept Christ and you look to God, all your life's going to turn around in one day, and suddenly you're going to be wearing all white and singing in the church choir, and all your problems will go away, because that's the happy Hollywood ending that we expect from our Christian movies, we're lying to people. So that's why Elephant ends kind of nebulously. Things are turning around towards something good. Redemption is starting, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to
No.
take time, and not everything's going to be restored because of your consequences. Some things are damaged for good.
That's right.
Some relationships in the movie don't pan out because too much damage has been done. The
Yeah.
love relationship in the film doesn't pan out. He's hurt her too much and she doesn't trust him anymore. There are long-term consequences to our sin. And so, if we promise everyone peaches and cream and roses at the end of every film, we are lying to people. Look at the Bible. It doesn't turn out that way every time.
That's right. That's so right. And that in its essence creates the arc of this movie is it starts out on a on an edge that's pretty sandy. Like I mean it's got a sandpaper essence to it. It's rough and it's rough in its presentation. And it doesn't just all go to roses and apple pie and all those things. It's definitely you're not going to be asked to do a Hallmark movie this week. Okay. I'm just
I'm okay with
I'm
that.
I think you would be. I think that would be. So thank you so much for diving into that part of it, because I think that was very, very important for the audience to hear. Because then we can go and we can see a lot of films through a redemptive lens and a worldview that is maybe not just explicitly from one viewpoint, but actually is redemptive in a larger frame context, in a larger frame. And that's what I feel like Searching for the Elephant is in its essence. So, hey, so as you're working now, you're in two worlds, because I know that you have to be working on something in the future while you're promoting something that in the now.
Yes.
Are you feeling a little schizophrenic?
You can answer that
Well, it makes it worse when we're working on multiple new things and promoting something of the past. It is odd, and it's funny to, think back on too,
That's
because
right.
every interview we do, I'm like, oh yeah, that did happen or something like that, because we just made it a little while
Yeah,
ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah, so it's a funny process, but I think David's probably much better about switching gears than I am. I'm fine talking about, the thing that has happened. That's easy to bounce back and forth between that and working on something new. But we have a couple different projects, we're working on now, and I have a harder time switching gears from one to the other. I kind of like to lock in on one at a
See,
time.
I love the writing process, though. That's my favorite part of filmmaking, which is odd because that's probably the least exciting of all of it. There's the getting the sets and the actors and everybody on place. That's exciting. And shooting and trying to beat the weather and trying to find a prison you can shoot scenes in and where you're
That's
going to find a prison, kind of thing.
right.
And that's all exciting, but kind of in a heart palpitating sort of way. I love the sitting at the computer and creating the stories. So whenever we get to that part of the cycle, I'm always at my most relaxed and most
There you
healthy,
go.
probably part.
I've done a little bit of script writing in terms of dramas, and people will say, how do you do that with all of the people that are, quote, in the room, so to speak, and you're writing, and I said, well, I hear them talking in my head, and they say, well, there's a medicine for that. You can get freedom from that, Keith.
Oh yeah, I hear them, I see them.
Oh,
So
well, there's a
I
medicine for that as well.
don't
So,
He's
oh my.
supposed to be taking it. I don't know how he
Oh, so what are you working on now?
We are actually working on a drama. It has a little bit of a romantic bent. We've never tried to write anything with romance. We've been so gritty and dramatic all these years that we're trying to write something that has a little bit of a romantic bent, and has to do with the Appalachian Trail, which is a huge, beautiful part of nature that's right here near our home. And some people journeying down the trail, and that trail kind of becomes a metaphor for life. And so we're looking at something kind of taking a little bit different artistic bent, kind of writing a little bit different style than what we've ever used to before. So we're having to retrain our brains and how to do the dialogue and how to do voiceovers and things like that. So it's a totally different style, but it's been a really fun challenge. And we've probably started this script about 20 times now, but I think we're on the right track
It's like you start, you do like 30 pages, you start from ground zero. You do 60 pages, you find a new path, and then you start from ground zero again. So it's been a lot, but I mean it's a good process though. It
Yeah, we're really happy with it. It's based off the book of Ecclesiastes and the meaning of life and wisdom and where we find it and what value we have and the things that we put way too much value in. So it's an exciting opportunity for us to kind of delve into something really specific like that.
I'm a section hiker of the Appalachian Trail, so
Oh, very good. There
I
you
do
go.
30 miles at a time or 60 miles at a time and just kind of keep them back. Never done a through hike or anything like
Oh,
that.
that's great. Wow.
But one of the interesting things about the Appalachian Trail and how it relates back to our lives is how quickly three things become the essence of everything you're about. You need water, and you don't have water until you find that spring, because drinking out of all the other water is contaminated. When
Yes.
you find out that there's a hog farm upstream, you can't drink out of that
Right.
one place. And then, the shelter and finding shelter and making sure that you and then making sure you have food. You know, those three things become the central focus very quickly. And I'll be looking forward to this script and how that evolves. And I love the fact that there's a whole new angle for you, the two of you in writing this. I think that'll be fun. So.
Well, you know, the trail
Yeah.
has its own culture. You've lived it, you've been through it, it has its own world. And we look for opportunities to take characters out of their regular world that we live in, the day-to-day job, work, school kind of struggles, and put them in some place where they can exist in a different world with a different set of rules. And that seemed
Yes.
like a grounded place for that to happen, where, like you said, the basic fundamentals of life are all that important. How often do we get to live that way? You know, how
That's
often do
right.
we get to experience life like that? And what does it do to our perspective when we do? And that's what's exciting about exploring these characters that
Love
way.
that. And I love that there's a relational aspect that is essential. We discover that we cannot walk alone. So I think that'll be an excellent study in the characters that you're creating. So I'm excited for that to come out and excited to be a part of that. I hope that we can have a future conversation.
Yeah,
And I
definitely.
can I ask you just one final question, if you will. How does one go about there's so many things about the industry that you're having to work with. How does one create an indie film like this? They looked at each other. That was the
Oh
moment, you
no,
guys.
Corey.
You could tell.
No, it's a good question though. And with, I mean, we kind of have to take it back to Cross Purposes then if we're going to talk about that.
Our very first little short film we did about five and a half years ago. We shot it on a $9,000 budget. People got paid, but not what they were worth. You know, we
Yes,
asked for
yes.
a lot of favors from a lot of friends, kind of thing. But we started with a story that we believed in. And we utilize resources in our community. We live in a rural community. We're not near Atlanta or New York or Chicago or even LA. We're out in Virginia in a very rural area. But we couldn't believe how much talent and experience and equipment we found in our community near us. And all it took was asking around. People wanted to help. People gave us their businesses to shoot in. We needed a hotel room for this short film. I'm sorry, a hospital room for the short film and a hospital unit. Well, we couldn't exactly hang up my CPAP machine in a bedroom and pretend like it was a hospital that anyone would ever believe. And so we thought, how are we going to get a hospital? We had no money. We can't. So we went to our local hospital and we talked to them. And they said, well, this wing is completely shut down because of a
Oh
nursing
my
shortage.
goodness.
This room, as long as you're quiet, you could just shoot your film in this wing. So we have an entire wing of a hospital that looks brand new. It's a fantastic hospital. It looks magnificent. And it looks like we spent thousands of dollars on sets to get this place. It's free. They didn't even ask us for anything. So as filmmakers, just talk to people around you. Have a story that you believe in. Make sure the story's good. Find actors that can do the job. I appreciate that your Aunt Martha is willing to be in your movie. And I appreciate that she probably gave you $100 to help make your movie. And she's a wonderful woman. We love your Aunt Martha. But she can't act her way out of a paper bag. So please don't make her a main character in your
Yes,
film.
please.
Nobody will believe it. You know? So make sure you've got actors that you can who really can do the job. And
Well, and David, that was really one of the things I was wanting to focus in on there is that you don't start with the full-blown production, nor do you have a script that probably would be able to hang meat on at that point. Start small, do the short film and learn the craft. And both of you, I love this about the two of you. Both of you have become students of an art form. And understanding the art of filmmaking is something that just it comes through both of you. Joseph, I'm just going to speak, you know, to your life. To have grabbed a hold of this as an art form at your age. Is a pretty significant moment. And I'm going to credit the man next to you for pouring that into you. But for you to have discovered that this is an art and a craft, and I have to immerse myself in it in order for it to really truly speak to those who are coming to the film and needing something in their life. And so I want to thank you guys so much for joining me on Story Mosaics. This has been a delight, And this drops every Tuesday, and I cannot wait to have this drop and for people just to have this moment with you. And a couple of things I want to make sure of, because people are going to ask questions like, and one of the ways that they can get in touch with me, and I'll make sure I pass everything along to these guys, but you can go to story.mosaics1@gmail.com. That's the numeral one, story.mosaics1@gmail.com. And if you have questions about what we've talked about, or you want to have a little bit more discussion on this, please send me something as well. And then the movie, can they at this point? I had a screening opportunity. I know it was in on Prime for a period of time. Is it coming back to Prime, or is it out of its
Yes,
lifespan? Where do we go?
it's coming. It should be coming back to Prime. It should be coming back to Tubi as well, and Roku and some other channels. If you go to our website, crosspurposes.productions, you'll find everywhere listed where you can stream the film. And all
Oh,
of our other movies as well, because we have three other films as well.
that's excellent. That's excellent. And I'll put that on the bottom third so everybody can make sure they get this if they're doing it in visual. And if they're just listening to the podcast, can you repeat that one more time, David?
Yes. But it's www.crosspurposes.productions with an S.
Right. And like they said, there's many opportunities to see some of their other work out there. And I think you'll see the scope of what they're doing. Thank you guys very much for today. And I appreciate your time and just what we've been able to accomplish today. I think what we've said and what we've done here has been significant in people's lives. So thank you from
Thank
Story
you. It's
Mosaics.
been delightful. Thank you for all your questions.
Great. Thanks. Take care.